Thank you for standing by. Today's conference call will be recorded. If you need any further assistance, you may press star, then zero. Marsha Burton, you may begin.
Thank you. Okay, well, welcome everyone to the Charm Telecon for this month being May. Gosh. We're lucky today to be joined by Professor Carl Murray, and Carl is from Queen Mary College in London. And in addition to being a member of the Imaging Science Subsystem, ISS, or the Cameron Cassini, he's an author of a textbook along with Stan Dermott entitled Solar System Dynamics. It's a widely used textbook. Some of his interests include orbital and particle dynamics, and one of his particular interests is the F-ring, and that's what he's going to tell us about today. I was snooping around the web and looked at Carl's webpage, and he's got links to a large number of public outreach presentations that he's made, appearances on the well-known British show The Sky at Night, and a lot of other media products. So if you haven't gotten enough knowledge about the F-ring, I'll point you to Carl's webpage at the end of the presentation. Again, if you're having any difficulty viewing the movies, Carl has a lot of animations in the presentation. You can view the movies outside of PowerPoint. That might run better for you. And with that, I think that completes my introduction. Carl, welcome to the Charm Telecon.
Thanks, Marcia.
Mm-hmm.
So please, I'm going to talk about the F-ring, and I'm probably going to get carried away sometimes. So if you've got any questions, anybody has any questions, please just interrupt me. I'll try and answer them as I go along. So what I'm going to try and explain is why this ring is so strange. I'll talk about the F-ring, how it was found, what we know about it. I'm not really going to talk too much about, let's say, its optical properties. I'm more going to talk about the dynamics. So just at the outset, say my collaborators are Kevin Burrell, Nick Cooper, Mike Evans, Gareth Williams, and Carlos Chavez. And I should also state, because I didn't put it in the slides, that all the Cassini images are courtesy of NASA, JPL, and the Space Science Institute. Okay, so if we move on to slide two. This shows a relatively recent picture of the Cassini image of the F-ring. On the right-hand side, you see the sort of Saturn's rings we know about, nice, regular-looking rings, which have got a lot of structure, yes, and you can see a little gap. That's the Keeler gap towards the outer edge of the A-ring. And we see lots of structure there. And that's kind of most of what we think of in Saturn's rings are nice, regular, well-behaved rings. Particles, for the most part, are near-circular orbits orbiting Saturn. And then you go out beyond the edge of the A-ring to the F-ring, and everything kind of changes. You've just got this really bizarre-looking ring, and it's a narrow ring. It's generally quite faint, but it has an awful lot of structure. And you can see just in this single image, it seems to have multiple strands. It's certainly not regular. It's got lots of structure both in radius and azimuth. And part of the key to what's causing that structure is right there in the same image, and that's the moon Prometheus, which orbits just inside the orbit of the F-ring. So I've shown you it's unusual, and that's what was always fascinating about the F-ring. And it's trying to explain why it's unusual. When you've worked out what all the satellites are doing to it, what the ring is doing to itself, just try and work all that out. So I'll try and take you through it and how our ideas have changed about the F-ring and how we really are with Cassini discovering some of the secrets. Okay, we move on to number three. So the outline of the talk is I'll talk briefly about the Pioneer 11 observations and then the key observations from Voyager, and we've got some HST ones as well, before I get on to the Cassini images. And I'll be talking about objects in the vicinity of the F-ring, evidence that we have for those sorts of objects. The key is the effect of Prometheus and how we come to understand what that is, and the evidence also for embedded objects. We've got features in the rings called fans that were we're understanding now are due to embedded objects. These are objects we can't see, but we can see their gravitational effect. And I'll try and come up with some conclusions at the end. So just to, again, put it in context, we have the main ring system, A, B, C, and D, working inwards. And the F ring, hopefully you can just see visible in that nice Cassini image, just outside the main ring system. So it's about 140,200 odd kilometers. And it's a narrow ring. The core of the F ring, and I'll try and explain what that means later, is about 50 kilometers in radius. But there are all these other strands which take the sort of whole F ring region, even just with the strands, out to several hundred kilometers. And as we see, the F ring region can even extend beyond that. So on to number five. So this is the Pioneer 11 image. And Pioneer 11 was the first spacecraft to visit Saturn. And the discovery of the F ring is just this beaded appearance just beyond the edge of the main ring system there. And there's a satellite, it's not Pandora, that might be Janus Epimetheus, just beyond it, just extend out beyond the ring answer. So this was September 1979 when the F ring was first discovered. And so we knew from the image, of course, that there was a ring there, but there was another source of data, and we shouldn't forget this about spacecraft, and that is that the fields and particles, if we move on to number six, this is from a paper by Simpson in Science in 1980. And I remember looking at this. Remember, the first Voyager encounter was in November 1980. So this is the publication of the Pioneer data. And what it shows is the flux of protons and electrons of various energies, both inbound and outbound. And what you've got to realize, if you had a completely uniform ring, the same sort of thickness all the way around, it effectively creates a sort of shadow. So as the spacecraft crosses that shadow, you would get this dip, if you like, in the flux of the protons and electrons. And what's more, the dip would appear at the other side of the planet as well. So inbound and outbound should be more or less symmetric. And what you notice about this plot is they're not. And this led to the idea, even before Voyager, that there was certainly something interesting about the F ring. And I remember, before the Voyager encounter, just looking at this plot and saying that this could be really fascinating. We've got those sort of images of a beaded appearance to the F ring, but you're never quite sure whether that's sort of lack of resolution on the imaging system on Pioneer 11 or there's something else involved. But this sort of data tells you that something really interesting. And you look in particular at the lower part of the plot, the B, with the inbound, and you see, if you like, an absorption feature right in the middle of this F ring region, inbound, but nothing corresponding to that outbound. That means it's kind of localized. There are structures in the F ring that are localized. And so this aspect, and it continues with Cassini, because the charged particle experiments in Cassini have actually shown the existence of some rings associated with the small satellites before they were actually imaged by ISS. So if we move on to the next one, now we come to sort of the classic picture of the F ring from Voyager 1. So remember, this is November 1980. And the images show this appears to be braided, twisted, with clumps and kinks. Well, I should say, braid sort of implies, by the analogy with our own experiences, a sort of three-dimensional effect, that there's sort of an intertwining of strands. So we don't really know that that's the case for the F ring. We don't know whether that was the case in the Voyager epoch or even the Cassini epoch. But it certainly has an unusual appearance. The clumps, you can see that the ring is not uniform. You can see multiple strands. You can see towards the top on the left-hand image the sort of kink, which is a discontinuity, that the ring just appears to suddenly go at a right angle before carrying on again. And the clue was the observation that the F ring has these shepherding moons, Prometheus and Pandora, on either side of it. And the little insert image in the bottom right, you can see a sort of overexposed image showing the main rings, the faint F ring beyond, and Prometheus, which is the inner shepherding moon, and Pandora, the outer shepherding moon, just beyond it. So the naturally, the F-ring was then going to be a target for Voyager 2, and lots of sequences were planned, I understand, were they were going to do an F-ring movie by looking at the ring and seeing how it evolved. And then, as you probably know, the scan platform on Voyager 2 sort of froze during the Voyager 2 encounter, which was in August the following year. And as a result, those images were lost. So we did get some coverage. So if you move on to slide number 8, if you look down the left-hand side, this is just kind of representative images. The one in the top left, which is sort of labeled 1, it's Voyager 1 image, I think is the classic one that you've just seen. The arrow in each of the images, by the way, just points in the direction of a planet, because some of them you're looking so close, it's difficult to know which direction. You don't see the curvature of the ring. But what you do see, certainly down the left-hand side and the right as well, is the multi-stranded nature of the F-ring. You're looking really close on the left-hand side, and you see at least 3 strands. On the right-hand side, if you look at that middle image, you're talking about 4, maybe 5 strands. There's always appeared to be a brightest strand, and that's essentially what we call the core, and that's what shows up in occultations as well. But there is a defining core. In fact, we have a very good orbit for this core that was derived from stellar occultations with HST and ground-based observations. And the F-ring is behaving remarkably well in terms of that core, in the sense that it appears to be an eccentric, inclined, uniformly precessing ring. So it's precessing, I'll just talk about precession in a moment, but it's moving through space as if it was just like a wire almost, and that the inner part of the core seems to be moving at the same rate as the outer part. It's almost as if it was one. So self-gravity and particles within the F-ring may be important in this context. But I wanted to illustrate just, you know, the question started arising right then. Was the F-ring fundamentally the same in Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, and we were just looking at perhaps different parts of it, or had something changed between Voyager 1 and Voyager 2? And it led the almost the expectation at that stage that the F-ring, every time you looked at it, it looked different. And that's something we're seeing again and again with Cassini. There's always something kind of new to tell us. And in this context, the Voyager 1, Voyager 2, when you look at it in more detail, you realize you didn't get anything like complete coverage, not at high resolution, with either Voyager 1 and Voyager 2. And when you've got the high resolution, you're actually looking at different parts of the ring, so you can't really draw many conclusions about what's happening elsewhere. But we do know that we have these F-ring shepherding satellites. So if we move to slide 9, and on the left-hand side, we've got some Cassini images. There's some better images of Prometheus coming along, but I've tried to show them to the approximately the same relative size. So Prometheus is the larger of the two and is the closer of the two. And so we're not actually convinced that the shepherding mechanism, which does work in other ring systems in the solar system, the rings of Uranus, the Epsilon ring of Uranus, for example, pretty sure it works there. But we're not actually sure it works for the F-ring, because the larger moon should be the further away. So if you look on the right-hand side, it's another way of looking at the elliptical orbits. Because all these objects, they are not on circular orbits. They're just ever so slightly eccentric. And the way to illustrate that is to plot the orbital radius as a function of the longitude around the orbit. Now, you do that, and if you just look at the top plot, which is labeled August 1981, which was the time of the Voyager 2 encounter, there's the F-ring in the middle, and the sort of grayed area is designed to show the extent of all the strands and things. And that's what an eccentric orbit looks like when you plot radius against longitude. The furthest distance away would be the apoaps, and when it's moving slowest, and the closest distance to Saturn is downwards in the plot, it's moving at fastest. And so you see, at that time, you see the relative configurations of the orbits, and you realize that at that time, Prometheus is getting pretty close to the F ring. And Pandora, not quite so close. But what you've got to realize is the orbits themselves move in space. So if you like, the ellipse itself is rotating. Now, this is caused by the fact that the planet Saturn, and you can even see this from ground-based observations, is not spherical. It's oblate. And the result for the orbits is that the orbits precess, which means the orbits, the periapsis, the apoapsis, the line of apses rotates in space. So to give you an idea how fast that is happening, at the F ring, that's happening at about 2 or 3 degrees a day. So it's really quite rapid, and it gets a lot more rapid as you move closer to the planet, and the effect of the planetary ablateness becomes greater. If you like, if you're much further away as far as the orbiting moon or ring particle be concerned, it's just sort of one central object and hasn't got ablateness. So what I try to illustrate with the red arrows is that there is differential precession. In other words, the orbits that are closer to the planet, so Prometheus, for example, will precess faster than the F-ring orbit, which will precess faster than Pandora's orbit. So you have differential precession. And that's kind of illustrated in the bottom part, which is the configuration that we thought would exist around February 1994, when Prometheus would be, its apoapsis would be aligned with the periapsis of the F-ring, which is the, if you like, the most dangerous configuration for the F-ring, because that is the absolute closest approach that you could get. Obviously, there are effects of inclination as well, but just everything in the plane would suggest this was a time when the perturbations that the F-ring would receive from Prometheus would be the largest. And again, it would drift away from that. So we suggested that this, when we got better orbits, as we did with ground-based observations and then with Cassini, we realized that this happens about every 18 or 19 years. And the last time it happened was actually at the end of last year. So Cassini's been watching the size of the perturbations of Prometheus on the F-ring building up over the time it's been in orbit. And it will continue to do so. And that's obviously the advantage of the Equinox mission and the Solstice mission, because we can see the effects, because we have some theories about how the Prometheus encounters the F-ring and how things may change once it's moving away from this close configuration. Okay, if we move on to slide 10, just to show you that when we were in this sort of interim period where we've got the Voyager observations and we're trying to understand those, it's time to, you can do some numerical modeling. And the Showalter and Burns paper from 1982, there's a slide from it on the left, what they did was develop lovely simple models of either a satellite on a circular orbit encountering an eccentric ring or in a circular ring or for different eccentricities. And they built up a picture of how the semi-major axis, which is the first plot, the change in semi-major axis occurs for different sort of starting configurations. And then the delta H, the delta K show how they're sort of coupled changes in the eccentricity and the periapsis. And then the delta theta, the changes in the longitude. And how they're all dependent on kind of obviously on what the sort of relative configurations are of the satellite and the ring particle. And on the right-hand side is something, hopefully we can now make the big leap, which is to go to rotating reference frame. So if you remember the previous slide, we showed this sort of nice sort of elliptical orbits. Now you say, okay, what happens if we're moving in a frame that's moving at the average rate of Prometheus? Because Prometheus is actually, and the F-ring are so close, it makes sense to kind of follow them around together. So if we're thinking of the orbit of Prometheus, what does it look like in a frame that's moving at its average rate? Remember, it's moving fastest at periapsis and slowest at apoapsis. So you can show actually that what happens is it just moves in a little ellipse. Okay, so this isn't the elliptical orbit around the planet. This is, if you like, a little orbit in a rotating frame that moves with the same at the average speed of Prometheus. So what you're looking at on the right-hand side is a numerical simulation of F-ring particles interacting with Prometheus. So at the start, the top, Prometheus is that little dot at the bottom of the ellipse, and it's at periapse. And then in the second frame, it's moved up to its apoapse. And you notice the ellipse hasn't changed its position. The unit on the left-hand side, the x value, the ellipse is centered on x equals 1. But the F-ring has come down to meet it, and that's because there's relative motion between the F-ring and Prometheus. And then in the bottom frame, Prometheus has gone back to its periapse, having moved from its apoapse. And what is much more interesting, if you look what's happened to the F-ring, you see that these three bands, which we sort of artificially introduced to try and duplicate the structures we saw in the Voyager 1 images, they've been disrupted. And you have this material that appears to have been dragged out by Prometheus from the F-ring. And then that material, remember this, the F-ring in this frame would be moving from, the particles would be moving from left to right. So that material has kind of moved on, and then Prometheus is prepared to do the same thing again. So in the next cycle, it will move up to its apoapse as the F-ring kind of comes down, and another structure will be created. Now, I should point out, this was work that my PhD student, Sylvia Giuliati-Winter, did for a thesis in the 1990s. And you could say, well, what are these things that are coming, all these particles that are streaming out of the F-ring? And we saw these, of course, in the Merglitz simulations, but we hadn't seen anything like that in the Voyager images. And, of course, we didn't really have a lot of coverage with the Voyager images. We lost the Voyager 2 observations with the scan platform jamming. And so we hadn't seen anything like that. So this was something we saw in the simulations, that the simulations said should occur, but we hadn't seen in the images. And so we sort of just put it to one side and thought, okay, simulations are telling us this, but we've not seen anything like that. Okay, if you move to the next slide, this number 11, this is some nice work Mark Scholter did with the Voyager images. And he was interested in the clumps in the F-ring. So there's a nice image on the left-hand side. There's Prometheus orbiting just inside the F-ring. And then he's labeled these various clumps. And then he plots their longitude in a rotating frame. So you can see if they're moving with respect to the frame that you've fixed them in. So he's tracking these things over 50 days. And so you can see the fact that they're sloped, these things have got slopes, these positions have got slopes, telling you that these objects are moving relative to the assumed motion of the airframe. And you notice that some of the slopes are positive and some of them are negative. And it corresponds to of the order of a sort of 100 kilometers, because remember, if you're outside the orbit of the F-ring or outside the orbit of whatever frame you decide to choose, let's say the motion frame of the F-ring, then you're, because of Kepler's third law, you're moving slower, and if you're inside, you're moving faster. So the slopes could be positive or negative depending on which side of the chosen frame that you are. And this is a key point which we'll kind of come back to later. So the point was that there are clumps that existed that could be tracked throughout an entire Voyager encounter, but what Mark couldn't do was to track them between Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, which suggests that even some of these bright clumps that were seen have lifetimes that are of the order of, you know, 1 or 2 months, but not 9 months between Voyager 1 and Voyager 2. If we move on to slide 12, it's just to illustrate, you know, every chance we get to, so that's analyzing the Voyager archive, but we, of course, have PHST images, and these are multicolor images that were taken around the time of the ring plane crossing. So at this particular time, the Earth was actually just above Saturn's ring plane, and the Sun was just below it. So you get this really unusual view of the rings, and we've seen something similar with Cassini observations. You move outwards from Saturn, the bright, broad ring that you see there is the C ring, and that's showing you that the particle sizes in the C ring are actually different from those in the B ring and the A ring. So then the darkness would be the actual B ring. Then the next bright ring that you come to is actually the Cassini division, and again showing up the fine particles that are in the Cassini division, somewhat similar to what you find in the C ring. And then beyond that, was actually beyond the main rings, is the F ring. In fact, some of the HST observations that were made right at the moment of ring plane crossing as viewed from Earth, you can't actually see the main rings, because the idea was to measure the thickness of the rings by looking at the change in brightness when the rings were viewed edged on. And they couldn't really do it simply because the F ring dominates the brightness of the rings at that time. And the F ring in that case appears almost like a donut surrounding Saturn. But the point of these images, the reason I want to show is you can see, if you look down the sequence of pairs, particularly the middle two and then the bottom two, you'll see there's actually arcs of material in the F ring. You see a bright arc that's just approaching the answer. So there were lots of ground-based and HST space-based observations at the time of ring plane crossing, because the rings are being edge on as viewed from the Earth, the brightness, their glare is reduced, and it's a great time for looking for faint structures and particularly objects associated with the airframe. So this was a highly successful observing campaign. And if you go to the next slide, which is 13, these are sort of summary of observations from McGee et al. Showing you're looking the axis, the horizontal axis, the semi-major axis, and then you're looking at this longitude epoch. So the orbits of Atlas, Prometheus, the F ring, and Pandora are indicated with the dashed lines. And then these other objects, okay, there are large uncertainties in the semi-major axis, which is basically the radius of their orbits. But you see they're kind of clustered around the region between Prometheus and the F ring and just beyond. So you're talking about sort of maybe 500 kilometers inside and 500 kilometers outside in some major axis. So lots of evidence for these objects. Remember, you're not fitting an orbit in the sense that you're plotting a position around the sky. What you're doing is you're calculating a rate and using Kepler's third law, to figure out where an object would be to be moving at that rate. So those are the HST observations, which again suggesting they're objects associated with the airframe. And we've got the charged particle data, remember going back to Pioneer, obviously Voyager data as well, all suggesting that the airframe is this unusual region and has got a very dynamic structure, to put it mildly. Okay, now the next slide is one where there are movies associated with it. Of all of them, I would say this is the one you don't have to go and download if you don't want to. On the left-hand side are a sequence of Voyager images. So this is so slide 14, and the associated movie, if you want to see it, is called S-2004-S. The one on the left is called S3-Discovery, and then there's the larger version of that, which is more than just a poster page. And then the one on the right, which is the S6 discovery, is S2004-S6, and there's a .mov. So if you want to see those, you can download those. So hopefully you can see that there's a sort of green box associated with both of these objects. I hesitate to call them moons, and you may be wondering why, if these objects were found as the temporary designation indicates, 2004, why they don't have permanent names at this stage, because we found objects last year. The most recent one, I think, is the Aegean, the G-ring moon, and they've already been named. And now the reason is that you need to have a good orbit before you can name something. In other words, could you actually recover it? And that has been part of the problem with the objects that we've seen with Cassini. So if you look on the left-hand side, this is, I'll just call these objects S3 and S6, just for convenience. S3 is clearly on the outside of the airframe. It's just a tiny little speck, but you can see it move around almost seems to define the outer limit of perhaps a strand separated from the core of the airframe. And there was another object found subsequently, S2004-S4, and we're now pretty sure it's actually the same object. And on the right-hand side is the S2004-S6, and it's clearly on the inside of the F-ring. And this was actually a high phase angle image, and therefore you're seeing lots of the dust that's in the F-ring, which is why it can look so bright. And this is just this tiny little object. So the fact that you can see it at high phase suggests maybe it's just like a dust ball or something. But the question is, what are these objects? And everything seems so nice because it's almost like this is a sort of mini shepherding mechanism. So this maybe at the time we thought went some way to explaining the strands in the airframe, because you've got a moonlit S3 on the outside that maybe does sort of local shepherding to the outside, and then you've got a moonlit S6 on the inside and does the same there. And that all seemed rather nice. But let me go on to the next slide, which is 15. And S3, S4, and S6 were just the first of many, many objects that we started to find. And you may think, well, that's wonderful. You know, these must be the objects that were detected by the ring plane crossing. Maybe they look perhaps too faint to be the bright things that Mark Scholter was seeing, but there are lots of them. And so, for example, this is just four frames from a movie of the airframe that we took in 2005. This was April 2005. And a point I'm making is each one of those, we've got something like 90 detections of it. That's the good news. The bad news is that they're covering a relatively small arc, and so of maybe, you know, only 10, maybe 20 degrees. So it's very difficult to detect an orbital motion that's different from sort of circular. It's certainly very difficult to work out elements that are good enough that are going to allow you to figure out what this thing should be the next time you look at the airframe, which might be a day later, a week later, a month later. You don't know. It's very difficult. So we have lots of catalog positions of these things, and we're always trying to fit them with new things that we see. And it's very, very difficult. But then these things are kind of part of the airframe, and we suspect that some of them are temporary, but we don't really know. Just to quickly go through some of the others, on slide 16, again, okay, we had fewer detections of these. Six detections means as we were sort of staring at the airframe, we captured these objects in typically six frames before they went out of the field of view. So that's just to tell you it's not just a piece of noise and a camera system. It's not a cosmic ray. These actually do move at the right Keplerian weights. It's just that we can't really get good orbits for them. And then if you go on to 17, you can see some more of these. Some of these are, of course, very, very faint objects. Now, I call them objects. You can't really call these moons in the same sense that you call Prometheus and Pandora moons. We don't really know what they are, and whether they're even solid, whether just balls of dust or very loose agglomerations of ice. We don't know. But they certainly seem to be associated with the airframe, and we find lots of these, and it's very, very difficult to get better orbits for them. Now, if we move on to 18, a really good piece of evidence, lots of good pieces of evidence, I should say, that come from the occultation experiments, some from VIMS, but particularly UVIS occultation. So these are two Cassini instruments that are primarily in the infrared and the ultraviolet, respectively. And obviously they're observing starlight as the starlight is extinguished by anything that's happening that gets in the way. And this is just a sample of observation that VIMS and UVIS have done of the airframe core, which is the main dip that you see in the middle, the sort of zero point. And there's this object to the right-hand side, which has got an estimated size of 479 meters. And these are the so-called cats, and the named after cats, so that's Piwacket. Now, the Esposito et al. Paper from 2007 showed 13 of these objects, and they were all within about 10 kilometers from the core. And most of them, I think there's only one exception in that paper, were semi-opaque. So you can tell by occultations whether these things are really solid, as they would be if Prometheus occulted the starlight, for example, or whether there's some starlight is getting through, which suggests they're much more loose. And so these are semi-opaque objects, and that kind of figures or sort of tallies with what we saw with some of these objects you saw in the previous slides. Objects that don't really look solid, maybe just sort of dust balls, possibly would reduce starlight, but we're not really sure. But the sizes of these objects, as you see in the quote there, about 30 meters to about 9 kilometers. So these are quite sizable, but you shouldn't confuse it with saying this is a solid object, a sort of 10-kilometer-sized solid object. These are most likely not solid. There was only one object that was opaque, I think, that was being detected. But it just shows you, again, how to build up the picture of the F-ring. We use every available instrument, from seeds and particles instruments right through to all the remote sensing instruments. And Cassini and UVIS, even though they're occultation data and they really just tell you what's happening at a particular radius, they can provide useful information that helps constrain models, and that's certainly something we're working on. Okay, so I now want to move on to the effect of Prometheus. So this is slide 19, and this is a couple of classic images. So these were taken just after Saturn orbit insertion. So if you remember the sequence, the spacecraft on the night of the 30th of June crossed the ring plane from below. The main engine started fired for about 90 minutes, cut off almost at periapsis, and then it came in this big arch across the rings for about 90 minutes. We were able to maneuver the spacecraft to look down in the rings, and it's where we got those amazing images of the unilluminated side of the rings, where we saw straws, first views of some of the beautiful waves in the ring system. And then we crossed the ring plane, and then we managed to take images of the illuminated side, so the from underneath the ring plane. Remember, till August last year, the sun was below the ring plane, so those were the brightest images, if you like. So this is two images. I've cropped the wide-angle camera image. Remember, ISS has got two cameras that are bore-sighted, the wide-angle camera and the narrow-angle camera. So I've tried to indicate with the square the field of view of the bore-sighted narrow-angle camera, and that's shown as the insert. And you can see that was our first really good resolution image of the F-ring. We'd seen on approach, we'd seen clumps in the F-ring, and we were tracking them, and we were starting to get an idea that there was a sort of multi-stranded nature to the F-ring, but it was really early on. This was the first beautiful view that we had, a reasonable resolution of the effort. And you can see just at the bottom of the image to the left, there's Prometheus. But we saw this incredible structure. It was described at the time as drape-like structure. We would call it curtains in the UK. But beautiful patterns, almost overlaying patterns, and you can see it very well in the narrow-angle camera. And, of course, the key to what produced those patterns, as we realized quite quickly, is right in the same image. It's Prometheus. And the subsequent months, now years of observations, have allowed us to understand this mechanism in much more detail. And it actually goes back to those numerical simulations that we did back in the 1990s. So if we move on to the next slide, this is a really beautiful image. This is slide 20. So it shows Prometheus, if you like, caught in the act, sort of stealing material from the airframe. But when I show this, I qualify it and say, well, it's not actually stealing, it's borrowing. Stealing sort of almost implies it's permanent, but it actually takes the material out by its gravitational attraction from the airframe, but then the material goes back again. And we'll see this in a moment if we can get the movies to work. But the right-hand image is just a close-up of the left-hand image. And you'll see also, if you look at the left-hand image and just follow the ring around, and I can tell you it'll be about 3 degrees away, you'll see a sort of dark channel in the ring at the same time. And it's sort of at a slight angle. So the streamer kind of looks radial, but the channel is sort of sheared looking. And then there's another channel just in the top right-hand corner of the left-hand image as well, which is even more sheared looking. So our task was to try and understand what was going on here, but we already had done some numerical simulations, and we understood in a lot more detail this whole streamer, we call it the streamer channel mechanism, because they're both aspects of exactly the same thing. Okay, now we're on to a movie that I hope everybody will be able to see. So this is, we go to slide 21. So this is the movie, spelled incorrectly, but it's called Prometheus, rather than Prometheus-S10, called MOV. There's a sort of version 5 and 6, but the big version is version 5. So hopefully you've had a chance to download that. And it's just cycling through part of a much larger movie that we took at this time. In fact, you've already seen some stills, those objects I showed you that are in the associated with the airframe are taken from some of these stills from the movie. So what you see is, if you've managed to get this working, which I hope you have, you'll see Prometheus come by and Pandora come by. So Prometheus is the inner one and Pandora the outer one. And you'll see, if you look closely, you'll see background stars moving from left to right across the field of view as well. And you can just see, at least at the beginning, you can see the edge of the A-ring and even a bit of the Keeler gap just to the right. But what I wanted to illustrate is, first of all, you notice there's structure in the airframe. Even before Prometheus comes by, there's kind of structure in the airframe. And then when Prometheus does come by, it has this kind of fixed pattern that moves with it, right? And it's the same pattern we saw in the previous image, in the sense that there are these channels, and they appear to be sheared the further away you go from Prometheus. And they're caused simply by the gravitational effect of Prometheus acting on all the individual particles in the airframe. You see, the bright part of the airframe is the airframe core. Now, again, I'll come back to this all the time. There's this bright core, which is probably about 50 kilometers in radius, and it has all this structure as well. It's not nice and regular. And you've got to admit that, you know, Prometheus must be at least the prime suspect when it comes to the object that's producing this structure, because it's, you know, over 100 kilometers, it's longest, it's got large gravitational effect, and it gets close. Now, what you don't see, because you're only looking at I don't know, 10, 20 degrees, something like that, of the airframe, is you don't see Prometheus moving relative to the airframe. You only see it, if you like, for a short part of its orbit. It actually takes about almost 15 hours to go once around Saturn, and the orbital period of the airframe particles is almost exactly the same, just slightly longer because it's slightly further away. So you also see, it's quite obvious, multiple strands of the airframe. And so at this stage, we were just beginning to understand what those strands were, because we thought, oh, the easiest way to create structure like that, and you know from the main rings, is to, as in the Keeler gap, is to put a satellite down in the rings and you create a gap that way. And that's what Daphnis does in the Keeler gap. That's what Pan does in the Encke gap. So you think, oh, well, maybe these little moons or moonlets or whatever we find are creating the separate strands. Maybe that's what's going on. But it's actually more beautiful than that. Okay, if we move on to 22, it's just to show you start of a technique that we've used quite frequently now, which is to kind of unravel the airframe. So what we do is we take images, and this is produced from the movie that you've just seen. So we take a sequence of images of the airframe, and we reproject them in a frame where the x-axis is now the longitude and the y-axis is radius. I'll show you further examples of this later on, but this is the closest we can get to sort of taking a snapshot. So it's like the previous movie, if we stopped it at one point and then sort of snipped either end of the airframe and then sort of straightened it out, like almost like a piece of string, this is what it would look like. And you can see just the right bit of Prometheus sticking out at the right-hand side. So you're looking at about 60 degrees in longitude there, and you can see very clearly the shearing, that the first one has got a near vertical slope, this little channel, and the second one has got a more gentle slope and so on as you move away. And what you're looking at is essentially Kepler's third law in action, that the material furthest away from Prometheus is moving, relative to Prometheus, moving fast. It doesn't matter whether it's inside or outside. I'll just determine the direction. So as soon as, if you have a radial structure created, as soon as it's created over that range of centimeter axis, it'll start to shear. And whatever's furthest away will shear most. And that's why you get the slopes. So six, just to give an idea of the scale, I think it's only, we're talking about a few hundred kilometers in radius here, but 1 degree of longitude at the orbit of the Earth ring is close to 2,500 kilometers. And this is 60 degrees. So there's a large sort of compression just to be able to see this type of structure. Okay, now, then the next movie again may cause some problems. So if we move on to slide 23, it's not labeled, but the associated movie is called New Big Movie. And I think it's worth downloading. This is a numerical simulation that was done by Carlos Chavez as part of his PhD work at Queen Mary. And hopefully you've all managed to view this. Now, this is a lot like a sort of animated version of those original simulations of the airframe that Sylvia Giuliani, Winter, Mitch Gordon and I did in the 1990s. So it sort of turned on its side, if you like. So if you the black blob there is Prometheus, and it's actually, although it's pretty squashed, it's on this little elliptical orbit because we're looking in a rotating reference frame. So it moves out to its apoaps, and then just over 7 hours later it gets back to its periaps. 7 hours later it moves out to its apoaps. So that's the orbit of Prometheus. You're looking in a frame, as it says, moving with the average speed of Prometheus. Now the F ring at the same time is eccentric, but not at least for the simulation anti-aligned with the orbit of Prometheus. So it moves out and it moves in to sort of meet Prometheus. So, and if you're wondering what all the sort of denser parts of the airframe are, those were sort of introduced. We had put in more particles there, introduced just to make them sort of denser and look like what we thought the sort of stranded nature of the airframe was. But the core is actually the middle of those three strands. See, so this is sort of like a cohort of particles. We're not following the whole ring around. We're just following a cohort of particles as they meet Prometheus. And hopefully, if you've got this working, what you'll see is that Prometheus goes into the F-ring. It perturbs the particles. The particles come out as a streamer, and then as Prometheus reaches its periaps, the particles go kind of back in again. And as Prometheus gets to its apoaps, you see a very clearly defined channel. And then it's repeated, and the streamer channel that you've just produced goes downstream and gets sheared. But the procedure still takes place. If you notice, the streamers kind of all point towards Prometheus, and the channels do as well. And that's one of the sort of byproducts of all of this. So it's an absolutely beautiful. And once you see it and you realize this is just the three-body problem, particles in the F-ring aren't interacting with each other in this simulation, or maybe they do in reality if they've got sufficient mass. In the simulation, all these particles are all orbiting Saturn, first of all, and then they're being perturbed by Prometheus as it comes out to meet them. So you see, remember, that one loop of this, as in Prometheus going out to apoaps, into to periaps, and out again, that takes about 15 hours. So that means that the structure of the airframe, if we're to believe the simulation, is changing on a timescale of hours. And we've already seen, remember, because of differential precession, that about every 18 years, the structure, we would expect the maximum perturbation from Prometheus because its apoaps is aligned with the periaps of the airframe. So it just illustrates, I think, beautifully that the dynamical effect, the effect of gravity. You've just seen gravity in action. It reminds me of sort of physics experiments where you had all those little test particles and tubes and things, and you'd see what the effect of sound waves would be in those because they're responding to the effect of the sound waves. It's like this. These are all our little sort of test particles responding to the gravitational effect of Prometheus. But of course, what is remarkable is that this looks a lot like the real airframe, and the fact that the airframe can change on time scale of hours is one of the keys to understanding what's going on. Okay, if we move on to the next slide, which is 24, this just illustrates the same thing, but If you didn't get the movie to work, this was just a sort of an insurance policy so that you could see kind of what's going on. You'll see the little dashed ellipse, which is the orbital path of Prometheus in this special rotating frame. So in A, it's almost at its periapse. So Saturn is off to the left-hand side, and then it moves out in B and C, getting to its apoapse, and it's probably close to between C and D. And it's created the perturbation, but you don't even really see the effect of it till in E, it's starting to produce the streamer, comes out, and then the whole thing sort of continues. And you get these channels, which then shear and kind of move downstream. And it's remarkably good agreement with the ring. And to do a like-for-like comparison, what we did was we took genuine Cassini images, which you see at the top on the left and the right, and we then reprojected them using our standard technique. So there you can see Prometheus in both of them, and you see the different phases. And then we, from the simulation, we did remember artificially enhance the particle density at a certain place to make it look like the real effort. But you see just how good the agreement is between, you know, on the left where you just see the sort of hint of a streamer coming out and evidence for sort of channels downstream, and on the right at a different phase, which I think is even better, you see the agreement between the structures that you see in the rings that are caused by the perturbation of Prometheus and the simulation agreeing with the Cassini images. It's really quite remarkable. Whereas at this time we had good masses because we've been doing orbit analysis of Prometheus and three good masses for these small moons at that stage. Now, the one thing that was missing at this stage was to, wouldn't it be great if instead of that movie where we saw in Cassini images, just looked at the answer and we saw Prometheus coming past, and you're almost like a static structure in the ring as it goes past, sort of like the wake of a boat on still water. Wouldn't it be great if we could actually follow Prometheus around for one entire orbit as best we could and see it as it approaches the Earth ring and then moves away again? And this is another movie coming up, I'm afraid, but hopefully this one is on the Cassini website and under videos. So this one was released. So what you're looking at, it's what I said, you'll see from the name of the observation below, it's F-ring streamer channel. It was to look at Prometheus, which is, you can see, it's the same frame that we've used before. It's bobbing up and down. It's moving around. It's a little ellipse. But you'll see its illumination is changing because it's actually moving around Saturn. So it's unlike a numerical simulation. This is now the real thing. So it's Prometheus, different illumination, moving around Saturn, and then the F-ring coming down to meet it. So what you see is you'll see it move up and down. So as it moves up, you don't see the effect on the airframe. It's only as it moves away you start to see the effect of the perturbation. The blanked out bit, I'm afraid, was just because Prometheus went into the shadow of the planet, and we couldn't do anything about that. So we had to pick up Prometheus when it came out from the shadow, which is what you see in the end bit of the movie. And there's a sort of beautiful kind of streamer structure created. So this is from lots of images reprojected using our standard technique. So you're looking, it's in a rotating frame, but you're looking on the left. The horizontal axis is, longitude, and the vertical axis is radius. And you're only looking at one, the formation of one sort of streamer channel, and of course it's just going to get repeated and repeated, and the one that's sort of side field of view is just going to shear off, and then the next one comes along. That's the beauty of this, is that it just gets, the same mechanism gets repeated and repeated. And it's only over time scales, as we now know, decades, that you get changes where you can get a larger perturbation because it's getting even closer. And so we've just been through that part of the moment.
Carl, did you say how long it took to acquire this sequence, this movie sequence?
Oh, yeah. And one orbit of Prometheus or the Earth ring is about 15 hours. So if you want to look at the whole of the F-ring and its encounter with Prometheus, you've just got to, in this case, we tracked Prometheus all the way around as opposed to just staring at the F-ring and watching things pass by. So it takes about 15, 16 hours to do that. pretty typical.
Okay.
Yeah. So if we move on to 27, so this is the dilemma. The dilemma is, what we want, of course, is a high-resolution image of the whole of the airframe, and it's something you can't get, because if you've got high resolution, that usually means you're in close. You're only in close for a short period of time, and you can't get to see the whole of the airframe. So if you, on the other hand, if you move further away, so you get more of the airframe in the field of view, you lose resolution. So there's a balance to be obtained. And so most of our observations of the airframe to try and get the kind of gross structure of the airframe came from taking observations usually outside 10 Saturn radii, sort of 10 to 20. Virtually any observation of the airframe we can get, we're very happy with. But these are illustrate the two alternatives. One is called the F movie, and this is where we kind of stare at the answer. Okay, and I don't know if you know it. I give the example: London has an orbital motorway called the M25, and I say if you sort of stood on a bridge over the M25 and looked at all the traffic piling on underneath, and just kept observing it, you know, there might be some driver who's lost, and you see him come by again, you know, so many hours later. But you can build up a picture, if you believe it or not, anyway, you can build up a picture of the traffic on the motorway, and it's unlikely to be the same, you know, several hours later. It's not likely to repeat. On the other hand, the F-ring, the material is not going anywhere. But if you do this kind of stare, this answer stare with the F-movie, and you do that for, as I said, just about 16 hours, the whole of the F-ring movie, or the whole of the F-ring is going to pass by your field of view. And if you do our reprojection, then you can kind of build up a mosaic, a 360-degree mosaic of what the F-ring looks like. Now, it's not technically a snapshot because it's taken 16 hours to produce it. But on the other hand, it gives you a very good feel of what's happening, what the structure of the ring is, sort of the gross structure of the ring. And if you're not too far away, you get some resolution as well, and you might see some objects, and you'll certainly see Prometheus pass by and see what it's effect. Now, that takes, to be safe, if we've got the time, we take about 16 hours to do that. The other type of observation, if you've got the time, is to do what's called an ASCAN, which is to speed things up. You say, okay, I'm not going to look at a specific inertial longitude by staring at the answer. I'm going to help things along by moving along in the anti-Keplerian direction and let the movement of the ring material through the field of view sort of make this thing a bit quicker. And what you're doing then is you're sampling at different inertial longitudes, which means you're learning things about how the F-ring behaves at other inertial longitudes. For example, on the left-hand side, remember the F-ring is eccentric. It's not very obviously eccentric, but it is eccentric. You might just happen to be looking at its periapsis on the left-hand side. So what you're doing is building up, if you like, an image of the ring based on the material you saw at periapsis. And for all you know, the material might be doing something different at apoapsis. And we actually had, in our first imaging team science paper in the initial discoveries, we got a nice observation where you can show that there's almost a mirror image if you look 180 degrees away at the structure that you see in the ring. On the right-hand side, the ASCAN will do things quicker, and you're sampling different inertial longitudes, and that can be important. But actually, the ASCANs, you probably know the story of the reaction wheels and so on, how we have to be very careful about their use. And we now know that ASCANs essentially are not good for the reaction wheels, and therefore we've essentially abandoned those because they are useful, but our F-movies will satisfy us. So those are the two different types of things you get. Now, if we move to slide 28, this is one of the key observations. So this is from a science paper by Charnoz et al. Sebastian Charnoz is an imaging team associate at Saclay in France. And this is what you get if you look at three different mosaics of the F-ring in this in a particular co-rotating frame, and they're actually duplicated. If you look at the left and right, the actual mosaic is duplicated. So you're looking over not 360 degrees, but 720, but it's the same. And you're looking at three different times. You can see the bright core, and the times that are written on the image, it's November 2004, April 2005, and May 2005. In fact, the April 2005 is the nice F movie that we saw, where you can see the Prometheus pass by and so on. But the key observation is that the strands have a spiral structure, because you see that they're sloped, but not they're parallel to one another when it extends over 360 degrees, but it's not parallel to the core. Okay, there's a lot of what looks kind of noise in the core, and a lot of variation. Some of that is real, and some of that are pointing errors. I'll show you some other examples in a moment. But the fact that you've got a spiral tells you, and these should not be confused with the spiral density waves that we know exist primarily in the A ring, that are caused by gravitational effect at resonances with small satellites. Janus, Prometheus, Mimas, other examples. This is different. This is a spiral that you would get if you started off with something that was radial and just sort of said go, and it's just produced by the kinematic spiral. It's produced by Keplerian motion. The fact that once you say go, whatever's closest object closest to Saturn is going to go faster than the object that's further away, and therefore you instantly get Keplerian shear. And after a certain amount of time, depending on how far away things are, it will wrap around 360 degrees. The point is, its actual radial extent doesn't increase any. It's just the spiral gets wrapped up tighter and tighter. And furthermore, in the paper, you can say, well, how could you produce something like this? Well, they talked about a few mechanisms. One was, it could be just a gravitational perturbation, that something kind of dragged something out of the ring. And, of course, there's Prometheus there doing that all the time. Except we know what Prometheus does, and this is on a vastly different scale, excuse me, to the sort of streamer channel thing we see. So you'd need a 100-kilometer-sized object to do that, and yet the only 100-kilometer-sized object we know about is Prometheus, and it's not doing it. On the other hand, the other mechanism that could do this is if you had a collision between an object and the F-ring core, then that could produce like a radial feature, could go far enough out, but we're talking about a physical collision, and it would have to be a collision rather than just a close approach, because just gravity by itself won't do it. You actually have to have a physical collision. You need a production of a jet, and that jet needs to shear, and that would produce it. And then the red arrows denote the points were, guess what, S, the orbit of S6, that little object we saw earlier, crosses the core of the F-ring. And that seems to be where some of these spiral features originate. And therefore, the suggestion was that perhaps S6 was responsible for producing those. So we move on to 29. This, you're going to see a lot of these, and they're all done to the same scale. So some of them you won't see the axes, but these are mosaics of the F-ring using the techniques I've said. So most of the time we use F-movies. We stare at the answer. We see material pass underneath. If we get the whole movie, that's more than 15 hours. We get 360-degree coverage in a co-rotating longitude, just moving everything to a common epoch. And then we also get radial coverage as well. So these are all reprojected to the standard 360, not 360 along the horizontal axis, and then minus 750 to plus 750, the zero point being where the core should be according to the standard orbit model, which goes back to Amanda Bosch et al., which was 2001-2002, which the F-ring core, despite, you can even see it in this image, which is the bright central thing near the zero point. It's still got an awful lot of structure, but despite all that, it still goes round as if it was a uniformly precessing ellipse with just single 10-meter axis. Okay, now, if, I'd like you to kind of put yourself in my position. When we first saw this, your first reaction, what on earth is going on here? You see the spiral structure very nicely. There's at least three wraparound spirals above the core of the airframe, and you can see two parts below. You can see, I'll annotate this in a moment, but I was just saying, kind of just put yourself in my position, position of my group. We were trying to understand all of this structure that you've never seen at this sort of level before. Remember, all these are just based on individual images that you've probably seen in the raw image site that come in of the airframe. This is kind of the big picture of what goes on. Now, you can't see any moons in here, but I can tell you where Prometheus is, because if you look, you'll see a sort of missing line effect just above the N and co-rotating. And just to the left of that, you'll start seeing, and it goes all the way right to the sort of the zero point, or just the darkened bit before the zero point where we didn't get coverage. You'll see what appear to be near vertical lines, but as you get closer to the airframe, you'll see they're sloped. Those are the streamer channels produced. Now you're looking at a completely different scale, but those are the streamer channels. So I can tell you that Prometheus is just to the left of that sort of missing line effect. Okay? If you look, if you've got a good monitor and you look just above the core, just to the right of that blacked out line again, you'll see another set of very, very faint channels, which appear near vertical, almost parallel with that line. And then as you move to the right, with increasing co-rotating longitude, the slope gets shallower and shallower. Those are actually the streamer channels associated with Pandora, which are very difficult to detect because Pandora is smaller and doesn't get as close, but we can see its effect on the airframe. But you see all this other structure as well, and what we're seeing are actually jets. And this is the same movie, goes back to the movie we saw earlier that was on slide 21, where you see Prometheus and Pandora come by. We actually had, I think, about 400 images in that. And so this is the movie, and it's all, you'll see it says Epoch, 12 hours UTC, 1st January 2007. All we did was essentially shift all the longitudes. And we do this as a standard. We shift everything to move to the same reference frame. It doesn't mean that we know exactly what the airframe looked like on the 1st of January 2007. This is the way we can detect motion with respect to the airframe, because if everything is moved with respect to the same epoch, using the mean motion, the average speed of the airframe, then we can see how things move with respect to that. And that's how we can look at evolution. So if you look at the next slide, you haven't seen it. Those are the arrows. The arrows are pointing out the shear direction just caused by the Keplerian shear. So anything with a semi-major axis below that of the core will move from left to right, and anything with a semi-major axis above that of the airframe core will move from right to left. Okay, and the next image, it's actually the same image, and now all I've done is annotate it. So you can see the Prometheus streamer channel region to the lower left. Then the sort of upper center, you see the Pandora streamer channel region. And you see these shear jets. And the idea of the spirals are what is the ultimate fate of a shear jet. Some of the jets are more radial than others. And we believe they're the younger ones. They start off radial. We believe that they're caused by collisions between objects and the airframe. And they start off radial, and over time they shear. And given enough time, as the jet is got enough material and bright enough, it'll shear all the way around, and you get a spiral forming. And it's going on all the time, as far as we can tell. If we move to, I'll just quickly go over this. This is just to show you the difference between the longitude coverage you get in inertial longitude, which is on the left-hand side. Where you get a very small range of the inertial longitude coverage, but by the time you move to co-rotating longitude on the right-hand side, you get a large amount of coverage if you've observed long enough, because you've seen the whole of the airframe pass.
So we're on slide 31 now?
Sorry, yes.
Yeah, great. Right.
The other point is that you'll see a large gap between sort of mid-2005 and late 2006. And this was because it's although we can do some science when the spacecraft is in equatorial orbits, it's pretty difficult to do ring science when you can't see the rings. And unfortunately, we had to call a halt to our F-ring observations at that time. But we sort of came back with a vengeance at the end of 2006. And we got a really good set of observations where there's lots of overlap, as you can see, between successive F-ring movies, where we got lots of coverage. And coincidentally, we just happened to find something really interesting. So we've moved to 32. This will give you an idea of why this was so interesting. This was an image that was returned on day 357. The original image is on the left, and then the image just before it and reprojected, and then that original image on next to it, covering 8.5 degrees in longitude and our standards was 1,500 kilometers in radius. And just to put it in some sort of context, this was a very bright event. There was an awful lot of dust produced. This, whatever this was as bright as the core of the F-ring, and it's extending in, you know, a long distance from the core. And you see it's sort of got a sort of like a triple structure. And you can see, even if you compare the two images, that were taken just a few minutes apart, I believe, you can actually see that the object has moved. And you can even work out from that what the speed is. When I say object, what this thing is, we're not really quite sure. We've got some ideas, and we think our old friend S6 is involved. But the point was that if you go back to our previous F movie, which was on 2006 day 329, there was no sign of this structure. But yet by day 357, it was one of the brightest things in the whole of the F ring. Now, if we move to the next slide, it's 33. This is just to show you what's been happening, what had been happening to our old friend S6 in the meantime. We'd realized, this is work that Nick Cooper was doing here at Queen Mary, that this object has moved, is actually S6. Now, you can only do this by assuming an orbit and seeing if the next detection fits that orbit and then moving, doing integrations where you're looking at the rate of change of these quantities and seeing if everything fits. And then we realized that, yes, that this was S6, but if you just look at the two images, first of all, it's an unusual appearance. Yes, there's a sort of a denser part in the middle, but it's got a very long sort of tail either side, which could be just material that's sheared off, but it's not material that's come off this object, and then it's sort of sheared, stuff that's got a larger centimeter axis sort of trails behind, but a smaller centimeter axis goes ahead. It's Kepler's third law. But even more interesting than that, in the 8 days between the left-hand image and the right-hand image, the object has moved from outside the F-ring to inside the F-ring. So we realized that S6 crosses the F-ring, and that S6, which is still our best candidate for an object that has been around since at least the start of our Cassini observations, it's still our best candidate for an object that is hitting the F-ring. I'll show you the evidence for this. First of all, on this slide, which is slide 34, this is a mosaic from this period. I think this is November. So this is before this major event. And, okay, we've got this missing set of images in the middle, and there's one, maybe two images missing on the left, which is this small sort of black rectangle. But you can see, if you're used to reading these things now, you'll see Prometheus is again close to where that missing image is on the left-hand side. Because you can see the streamer channels there, and how if you then follow it, going over to the 360 side and follow it from right to left, you'll see the different angles as it shears. And you see how the Prometheus perturbation goes right across this whole region. Remember, you're looking, the mosaic covers 1,500 kilometers, so that's at least 500 kilometers that perturbation is going across. And then again, if you look closer, you'll see in the large black dot area in the middle, you'll see the Pandora streamer channels, different slopes, and they're almost vertical, probably where Pandora is, and we didn't capture in those images. But the point I'm trying to make is that is a pretty typical image of the F-ring. You see small jets, you see spirals, but it's pretty quiet. On the other hand, if you go to the next image, not I noticed in the PDF this didn't come out, so I'm hoping it's on the PowerPoint. This is slide 35. It should say 1545 on the top left, and on the top right, 2006, day 357. So this, if you can see it, and I hope you can, is the mosaic that we made, of which is included that one image that we got from that showed this triple structure object. So that's the object, the bright thing. Now it's all kind of squashed up that you see just left of center, and there's a bright bit just below the core of the ring. Now that just kind of puts things in context. If you want to go back to 34, there's the F ring at the end of November. Now there's the, in 35, there's the F ring in December. Something dramatic happened. Okay, if that image didn't come out and you're looking at the PDF, hopefully it'll be a bit clearer in the next slides. If we go to 36, this is the first of eight images we're going to see of these mosaics. So each A, B, C, D, and so on is of a complete 360-degree mosaic of the F ring, minus 750 to plus 750. So there in A corresponds to the mosaic you've just seen. And the little circle is our best predicted position of S6 based on the best orbit we had available. The square is based on the orbit of an object that we saw, and you'll see in the next slide, but if you stay with 36 for a minute, it's based on an orbit we derived for something we'd seen in later mosaics, and just showing you where it would appear in those images. So if you now follow the sequence, so we're going A is 2006, day 357, then we're into January, 5th of January, in B, you see that you're starting to see jets, and some of them are starting to shear. But the predicted position of S6 has moved from left to right because of the semi-major axis that's below that of the F-ring core. And remember, that's the direction it would therefore move. But you see how closely it's matching the brightest jet, the radial jet. And if you look at C, you'll see there's a jet that's formed, or if you look on the left-hand side, you'll see a jet that's formed and is already sheared, and you'll see another jet that's already sheared, and you'll see almost radial jet at the same time. And it's almost like a sort of progression as you go forwards in time. So in D, you're in day 58, 2007, and the S6 is making its way through, and yet again, it's so clearly associated with the S6 orbit is this very bright jet. And so you see other jets have formed and sheared. So this is what we think is going on, that this particular sequence of events was actually caused by S6 colliding with the F-ring. If we move to 37, you'll see the last four in this. And you can see in this little insert in the top right of F, G, and H, which shows the object that we're talking about, for which we derived an orbit, which is the square symbol. And so we're pretty sure that object is S6. If it's not S6, it's something that's associated with S6. So this S6 appears to be responsible for a whole series of jets that occurred throughout the first part of 2007. Now, in case you think it's the only culprit, if you look at G, which is 2007, day 108, which is the bottom left image, look, it would be around 10, 20 degrees of longitude, you'll see another jet that isn't, that you maybe see a hint of in F and a radial feature in E. And that's telling you that even as S6 is doing its business and colliding with the F ring and producing these jets, have to be other objects. If you believe the mechanism works, there must be other objects colliding with the F ring, objects that we can't even see. And so the jets form, they shear. They eventually shear all the way around and produce the spiral strands that we can see on the pictures of the effort. And just to show this, this is sort of more like a proof of concept. What we did here was we take the top images, which is one of our mosaics, and we sort of start labeling them for the outer jets and the inner jets. So that's O1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then I, 1 to 6. And you say, okay, I've measured where those jets originate from. Can I therefore work out just a simple model, create a radial jet, and then of of test particles, numerically integrate them just under the gravitational effect of Saturn after they've been created. So you sort of have a little radial spray of particles. You give them more or less the orbit of the F-ring with just small changes. The impact velocity we worked out for S6 and the F-ring is about 30 meters per second. So it's not the sort of, you know, tens of kilometers that you would get from some interplanetary object hitting the F-ring. It's a local object, and everything seems kind of consistent with that. So this is just a proof of concept to show that you can, for each one of these jets, you can assign a particular event at a particular time at a particular longitude. And ultimately, we should be able to use that sort of information to work out where some of these other objects are. If you move on to 39, just comparing, which is kind of interesting, comparing the F-ring as we saw it back in 2005 with the F-ring in 2007. And overall, they've got a very similar kind of behavior. You see the very bright jets. You see the structure in the core. You can see, certainly in the top image, you can see the effect of Pandora. And Prometheus, you can see the effect of in both of them. So perhaps it's caused by the same object. So if it's S6, which we certainly believe it is causing most of the jets, maybe it's something about the orbit of S6 and how it gets affected by the F-ring, because it's obviously colliding with material in the F-ring. Perhaps these loosely bound objects that we think exist, that maybe they're sort of the cats that the UVIS and BIMS people have found. And, of course, the F-ring structure isn't uniform. We're pretty sure about that. So it doesn't mean that every time it crosses the core, it's going to hit something. Maybe it has to just wait for the right time and hit something and produce a jet. So we've got a kind of ready-made mechanism. We have to look at the orbits and figure ways of getting these things switched on and switched off. But this is clear association between objects like S6, perhaps S3 as well, if we knew where it was, that are colliding with the core and producing these structures. So quickly moving on to slide 40, what other evidence have we got for objects that could be in the core? So this goes back to the idea that if these are objects that may be so small that we can't see them, but we can deduce that they've got mass by their effect on the other particles that are around them. And this is a phenomenon that we spotted in some of the images. You don't see it in every image, but you do see it in some. And these are three examples. We call them fans because it just looks like a fan. So you'll see, if you look closely in the middle of those red ellipses on slide 40, you'll see these channels that appear to emanate from one source and go out radially from there. And the task was, well, how do you explain that? And it was numerical integrations that did it. So to understand this, if you move to slide 41, you may have heard of what are called propellers, which Cassini has observed in the A-ring. They're located in various parts of the A-ring. And we know that they're caused by embedded objects. So this is I'm sorry it goes back to rotating frames again, but it is the way to look at this best. Right in the middle, this is numerical simulations, but you're looking at the trajectories of particles. And there's a satellite, a little mini satellite, buried at the origin there. And you're looking at the material in this particular frame that's coming from the left-hand side above the satellite and on the right-hand side from below. So if you look at the direction of the arrow, so the particles are approaching, and they really no idea that the satellite is there until they're almost right on top of it. And then, of course, they get a perturbation. And the closer they get to the satellite, the larger the perturbation. But there are a number of things going on here. One is that if you're really close to the orbit of the satellite, that means essentially you're moving at the same speed as the satellite, and therefore your relative motion is very, very small. And that actually allows the satellite to turn round the particle. So this is what's called a horseshoe orbit, and this is actually what Janus and Epimetheus to the moons of Saturn are executing at the moment. So every 4 years they kind of meet one another. They exchange angular momentum, and the one that was on the outside goes inside, and the one that's inside goes outside, and off they go again. And then 4 years later they meet on this diagram would be on the other side, and the same thing happens. So this is in units of what are called the Lagrange distance, which is the distance of or the Hill sphere, if you're familiar with the terminology. So this is where you'd expect the gravitational effect, the what are called the L1 and L2 points, to determine whether objects are going to be captured or not. So as you move beyond about 2 Lagrange points up the axis, you get to a different type of behavior, which I've labeled the chaotic zone. So between about 2 and 4 of these Hill spheres or Lagrange point distances, the orbits are chaotic, and sort of small changes in starting position are going to give you radically different results. And that's because the particles are essentially getting very close to the satellite. And beyond that, you move into the passing zone, where you just get a nice little wave structure. And these are the edge waves that satellites like Daphnis creates on the edge of the Keeler Gap and Pan creates on the edge of the Encke Gap. But the overall pattern that you create, this kind of offset pattern, if you look at the trajectories, is the propeller structures that have been seen in the A-ring. Even though the objects that are causing them have not been seen because they're a few hundred meters in size and below the resolution limit, the features they create are much bigger and propagate and can be seen. So, okay, what has this got to do with fans? Well, hopefully the next slide, which I'm sorry comes to another movie again. So this is slide 42. And the movie is one of these called New FCR, and then this is ECC0, because if you've managed to get that working, this is a satellite which is at the origin in this frame, so it's moving with the same motion as the F-ring, but it's placed right at the edge, the inner edge of the F-ring. And the F-ring in this movie is 50 kilometers in radius, and it's pretty static. Things are actually happening. You might, if you've got the movie working, you'll see the particles kind of drifting from right to left, and you'll see essentially a half a propeller. It's a different frame than we looked at before, which is why the blades are in a different position, if you like. But the propeller structure is created by sort of like the envelope of all the particles that are approaching the satellite getting perturbed. So some will go in horseshoe orbits, some will go in chaotic orbits. You can see, if you kind of look at the top, you'll see a sort of effervescence of particles kind of bubbling over the top past the satellite. So that's to the left of the origin. And there's sort of similar things happening down below. The particles that are sort of meeting the satellite on these chaotic orbits get these large changes in orbital elements. On the other hand, if you go just a bit beyond, you get the more regular, and you can see the essentially the edge waves as you move further away. Okay, so that's what happens. I mean, it's a bit boring, but that's essentially how propeller structure is created. So what's that got to do with fans? Well, what happens if the satellite has just got a slight eccentricity with respect to the F-ring? It actually doesn't matter whether the F-ring is circular and the satellite's eccentric or vice versa, or a combination of the two. You can show dynamically that it's all equivalent. So if we can move on to 43, this is animation. This is new FCR ECC4. And so now the satellite is the embedded object is moving on an eccentric orbit. So this is our little ellipse coming into effect again, just like we have with Prometheus. This is like a mini version. But this time the perturber is right at the edge of the core. So what hopefully you can see is that the nice steady pattern that we had with the previous movie has changed. And we get every half cycle, you can see what effectively are the fans. You see them to the left, i.e. downstream of where the satellite is. And you'll see the sort of beautiful structures. You get a very well-defined edge on the right-hand inner side, and then it kind of disappears again and becomes much more diffuse. And these are all because the particles are responding to the perturbation from the embedded object. And this is only this is an eccentricity that's only about 10% different from the eccentricity of the F-ring. And you can even work out the mass of the object because it's related to the width of the channels that are part of the fans, and it's related to the mass. So there's this relation. So if you measure the width of the fan channels, you can actually get an estimate of the mass of the object. Just like the propellers, even though you can't actually see the propellers, you can work out something about it. Now, just to kind of, if you move on to 44, this is from a paper we did in 2008, where you comparing an actual Cassini image reprojected again, but done to the same scale as the numerical simulation. And there's a frame from the numerical simulation showing that just happening at the phase where you see on the right-hand side the fan structure, and there on the left-hand side you see a fan structure among Cassini images. And the match isn't perfect, but you seem to get the sort of the discontinuity. You seem to get the fans more or less at the correct angle. And the point is that if there wasn't all this material above the airframe, you wouldn't see the fan, because you need the actual perturbed particles to see the fan in the first place. And we also know, and we've seen examples of this, that the fan mechanism that we envisage would predict that when the satellite is at a different part of its phase, you're not going to see a fan. And we've actually got examples where we've managed to capture the same part of the airframe at different phases, and in one we see the fan and another we don't, and we think that's consistent as well. So it's this idea that the test particles, the dust, if you like, in the airframe is really acting as a sort of tracer, and we can see mechanism by which these embedded satellites are creating the channels. And if you like, it's an extension of what Prometheus is doing on a much larger scale. So if we move on to image 45, slide 45, you can see these, and there's one of the press-released images on the left-hand side. And if you take that and use our reprojection technique, it really works wonderfully here. So this is actually the same information. We may have cropped the ring a bit away from the answer. But the same information, you can sort of see a hint of it if you look in the image. But there are actually two fans in that image, suggestive of embedded objects. That's slide 45. Now, then say, right, well, we did get a time, we got an ASCAN in September 2005. It was really quite remarkable. We got some of the most beautiful images of the airframe. So if you move on to slide 46, we had something like this, which I think gives this beautiful sort of wispy appearance. So the core is still there. The core is still that bright strand going through all this. But you see evidence, those tiny little objects you see to the left of the image, just below the core, and some to the right. Perhaps those are the cats, those are the objects that we believe are around the core region. But the beautiful structure in the middle, you think, well, what could be producing that? Now, I'm not saying this is the right answer, but I just wanted to illustrate a possible answer. So if we move on to 47, and I've promise this is the last animation. So this is new, I think it's B11A _1 movies, and there's a _int. If you've got this working, about halfway through the movie, it starts off like the first non-fan movie, when we had the object on a circular orbit and you're essentially looking at a half of a propeller. And then if you've got the movie working, you'll see about halfway through its animation, what happens is Prometheus comes by. Now remember, this is the embedded object is on a nice circular orbit, so you've got a sort of fixed pattern, but the object's in horseshoe and chaotic orbits. But if you've got this running, when Prometheus comes by, you'll see a very dramatic change. So what happens is the ring particles get perturbed, and the embedded satellite gets perturbed as well. So the embedded satellite is still trying to do its job, and it's still meeting particles that are coming by, and it's still trying to put them on horseshoe or chaotic orbits or passing orbits, and it's having a hard time doing it. And even downstream, of course, has had the effect of the Prometheus perturbation. It's trying to cope as well. And I'm not saying this accurately reproduces what we saw before, but it gives you some indication that just with a simple model like this, with an embedded object that's already creating structure in the ring, and Prometheus passes by, the response of the ring is not just the streamer channel. It will be the effect of whatever the embedded objects are, which are themselves perturbed, producing all these beautiful structures. So it just illustrates, I think, that this sort of simple mechanisms can produce some very complicated structures. So just to finish off, this is a much more recent image. This was actually January of 2009. And, of course, we know in August we had the ring plane crossing. And you start to learn how to read these images now. Hopefully you can see the bright core. Notice we knew that once we got the orbits worked out, the Prometheus would never actually get to the core. So it's got to some inner strand of the core, quite a bright inner strand. It's just about reached there. But there's actually a shadow. You can see Prometheus has created a shadow just sort of below the actual disk of the object. But what is more interesting, actually, is to the right. So you can see the latest channel that Prometheus has created, and there's a hint of another one just before it. And it's fascinating because there's a kind of a structure where if you look at the channel isn't empty. It appears to have this kind of island structure in it. And even more interesting, if you look where it crosses that strand, you'll see that there appears to be like almost like a central core. It's almost like a sort of a wire where the sort of the plastic insulation has been stripped off, and there's a little piece of the metal wire underneath. So how can you explain this? Well, this is, of course, getting close to the time when Prometheus was actually getting its closest approach of all time to the EFRAM, which was at the end of 2009. And if we go to slide 49, you'll see this is from a paper by Carlos Chavez, and this is from numerical simulation. And there's very similar, there's the core where there are more particles introduced in the simulation. The little triangle towards the top of the simulation is where Prometheus is. And you can see this sort of island formation and how Prometheus has produced that in the channel. So this is at a configuration when Prometheus is the airframe are near anti-alignment, which is a situation that arose at the end of last year. But it also shows rather nicely that just because the core gets perturbed, and believe me, the core is perturbed, even though it doesn't look like it in this image, all that's happening is, comparing with the previous one, you just happen to catch it at that particular phase of its cycle where it's going back through its original orbital radius. So an hour or two either way, and it would look totally disrupted. But at that particular time, it just looked like it hadn't been affected. So we used to call these the indestructible ring. It looked like it was completely immune, but it's not. It's been perturbed like everything else. And it's not indestructible. It just is responding. So again, it shows you how sort of these relatively simple dynamical models can explain kind of this complicated structure. So, just come to some conclusions. I've hopefully shown you that we've now got evidence that there's have to be several hundred small of these moonlet clumps in the vicinity of the airframe. We've seen lots of them. We've now got evidence from the occultations that these objects exist. They're almost certainly not solid. They're sort of fluffy type objects, but we're pretty sure they're there. We understand how Prometheus creates the streamer channel structures in the airframe. We've also got really good evidence that objects such as S6 are hitting the core and leading to jet formation, so we understand that process. We understand the fans, and they're suggestive of the presence of embedded objects, which then themselves can get perturbed, producing even more complicated structures. And this nature of the F-ring, we think, can be understood by relatively simple processes. And we've got lots of theories and lots of things we're still trying to understand about the F-ring. We've got lots of things in progress. Hopefully be reporting on those soon. But as I said, there's no such thing as a useless image of the F-ring. Every single image is useful for constraining our theories. And therefore, with the Solstice mission approved, we're going to have some incredible opportunities to study this most amazing ring. I'll stop there.
Well, thank you very much, Carl. That was really interesting. I especially liked the way you put it in the proper chronology. And, you know, people can relate to how these discoveries have been made over the course of the Cassini mission. So that was really nice. Are there questions out there in telecon land for our speaker? Don't be shy. I guess not. I've got a couple questions. I heard a rumor that you've got a paper coming out soon, probably in one of the major journals, maybe Science or Nature. Without giving too much away, can you tell us what might be some of the major ideas in that paper? Just kind of give us some hints.
I'm not sure what I can say.
If you're uncomfortable saying anything, we have kind of stringent restrictions on material that can be presented in these telecons. It needs to be press released. So certainly the images that Carl showed are all press released. But maybe you could just tell us what journal we could look for it and maybe when.
Okay. I don't think it's going to be Science or Nature, but we're making final revisions to a paper, and I'll probably get back to that tomorrow. So I would say hopefully within the next few weeks, and there might be something. I'm sure the Cassini Press people, they're certainly aware of what's going on, but we think it's a really important result, and it's got, let's put it this way, it's got wider implications beyond the airframe. Because one of the reasons that we obviously have a mission that's going to Saturn is to study the rings, and one of the reasons we're studying the rings is because they're an analog of perhaps what the early solar system was like, when you've got a disk, a protoplanetary disk, out of which protoplanets formed, and then the protoplanets are interacting with the disk. So if we can understand Saturn's rings and all its variety, hopefully we'll get some insight to what went on in the early solar system. I think the airframe is one of those examples. So hopefully that will whet people's appetite.
Well, that's great. That was going to be my next question. I mean, you must get that a lot from, the media asking about, protoplanetary disks and all these processes that certainly must be going on there. So it sounds like your upcoming paper will have
I think one of the things that's starting to happen now is, for example, the propeller structures that we've seen in the airframe with Cassini images. Those are so familiar to people who work on numerical models of planet formation. And when a protoplanet forms, you get exactly the same kind of structures of an embedded protoplanet in a protoplanetary disk as you do from those propellers in the A-ring, because it's completely different scale, but there's the same physical processes. Even though the collisions are just so much different, but the physics is the same. And that's definitely one of the reasons we went to Saturn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. Okay, well, we'll look for that. For people out there, I think usually when a paper is released, that JPL Media Relations often will issue a press release, and you can find those linked to the JPL website. So when Carl's paper comes out, I think you'll find that online. Are there any questions that people have thought of?
Well, I was just wondering, this is Julie Taylor, if you can, you have an idea, these are probably icy objects?
Yeah, what we do know about the photometry is it's essentially these are icy objects. They're also dusty in the sense that they're small. The airframe is predominantly composed of micron-sized particles, and that's why it's so bright at high phase. If you remember the very famous image of the one that has the Earth in it, where we were in the planet's shadow and we did these long exposure mosaics, the F-ring is just so bright in those images. And you can see the E-ring, but the F-ring is much brighter than the E-ring. So it tells you you've got a large component of micron-sized material. On the other hand, we know from Voyager occultations and others since that there is something in there that's got optical depth that's capable of blocking sunlight. But spectrally, yes, it appears to be mostly ice. And that's one of the things I'm looking forward to actually from the other instruments is to, and I know BIMS and people are working on this, that, are there real differences between Prometheus, Pandora, and the F-ring spectrally, because if we're interested in the origin of the F-ring, if it all came out of one object that kind of broke up and then all these things started interacting, then we'd expect them spectrally to be the same. But on the other hand, if there's some interlopers and objects that come from different parts of the system, then that would be interesting and we'd get some evidence from that spectrally. So that could all kind of feed into the dynamics. So. that answers your question.
Yes, thank you.
Any other questions out there for Carl? Okay, well, thank you very much, Carl. It was a very interesting talk, and we appreciate it. Just want to mention that next month's Charm Telecon will be our, believe it or not, sixth anniversary in orbit at Cassini, and this is we do this every year. It'll be a two-part telecon, and we'll have a speaker from each of the different disciplines. Linda Spilker, the new project scientist, will give an overview. We'll have Jeff Cuzzi talking about rings, Andy Ingstack talking about atmospheres, Elizabeth Turtle on icy satellites and Titan, and Claudia Alexander on magnetospheres. So we're going to break this up into two parts, and I'm not sure which of those speakers will occur when, but it'll be June and July, so I hope you can join us. Are there any comments from anyone out there before we conclude?
Oh, thank you. This is Gladys from Puerto Rico. Thank you. This has been a really interesting telecon. I always learn so much from them, so I really appreciate all the effort that goes into preparing them. Thanks.
That's really nice. It does take a lot of effort for the speaker.
Yeah. And for you, too. So
oh, not so much, but it's really interesting. We really appreciate it. It's a good way to reach a large number of people, and we do appreciate it, Carl. Any other comments? Okay, so we'll talk to you all next month.
Excellent.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks. Bye.